But of course, January 31st, Winter Jazz Club, Jazz Showcase February 12th. You've got plenty of opportunities to go check this out. And I mean, hopefully, talking to Marlene, you guys have seen her play, but now you know the fascinating story behind Marlene. And you can go in, and if you have a clarinet, I'm sure she'll be happy to talk to you about that too. Everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, ChicagoJazz.com, Chicago Jazz Magazine. Welcome to Talking Jazz with Mike Jeffers. We are here at Johnny O's, episode 121. I am here with the great bassist, Marlene Rosenberg. She made it down here to Johnny O's. She's thoroughly impressed with the atmosphere.
Absolutely,
I can already
impressed.
Tell.
Yes.
Actually, we both probably played in some places that were
similar.
Not as impressive.
No, not at all as impressive. Right.
So I wanted to have you on because you're obviously, you know, you're one of the top bass players in the country. So that's one thing.
You,
but you also are locally here in Chicago.
Correct.
Which I want to make sure everyone knows about. And you have a very interesting show coming up January 31st at Winter's Jazz Club. It's a tribute to Bill Evans.
Right.
Now, did you ever play with Bill Evans or did you meet him?
Never met him. I did see him at Rick's Cafe.
Okay.
When it was in the W Hotel, whatever they called it back then.
Yeah, well, because I know I run into different people that either hung with him sometimes, or they played with him, or they just randomly had an encounter with him some random place or something, because
right.
he seemed like a real personable guy at some points. So Tom Mueller on piano, and everybody will remember Tom Mueller from episode 100. He cooked sausages in the back.
Yeah, I'm making this Polish sausage for Eric Schneider. It's been marinated in Malort. The onions have been marinated in Malort as well.
And then Rodrigo Villanueva.
Villanueva?
That's what I said.
Villanueva?
Right? Yes.
Yes.
What
that's
she
exactly.
Said. I apologize, Rodrigo. It's very early again. He's playing drums. It's gonna be a killer group. How did you come up with a tribute to Bill Evans? I mean, the obvious opportunity, but you're a bass player, right? So was
right.
it Eddie Gomez? Was it Mark Johnson kind of inspired, or was it just the music?
I figured, who would know Scott LaFaro or Eddie Gomez, a tribute,
right.
and they go, who? So Bill Evans, and plus, you know, my guy Stan, he had an idea. Mm-hmm. We're thinking theme. A lot of people like the theme idea in the clubs
right.
these days. And Bill Evans, when I was in school learning the bass at U of I,
mm-hmm.
my two favorite albums that I wore out was Live at the Village Vanguard, or Sunday Live at the Village Vanguard, and Ray Brown, and this one's for Blanton, Duke Ellington
mm-hmm.
and Ray Brown. So those two, and Bill and Scott LaFaro has always been a favorite of mine, and so I thought, and Bill Evans is amazing. And
you know,
now comes out, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The video Time Remembered.
Yep.
And it just seemed like, this is great. I love his music.
Well, I think you're right with the theme thing too, right? Because as you know, I mean, to think about it, what, Bill Evans died how many years ago? 30 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
about where we're
Probably.
At now with that? Which is amazing, but people still transcribe all of his tunes, are constantly learning and all that. But also, to me, that group, those different trios that he had with the different rhythm sections, it flowed so well with his playing. And is that something that I mean, you know, as a bassist, you've got to sit there and listen to this, and I don't hear any other groups ever sound like that, the way, the fluidity and how they're doing it, you know?
Right.
I mean, because it's not, there's straight ahead stuff in there, but there's so much fluidity inside, and they're all talking to each other within the context of the tune.
Correct.
Do you think that's kind of like because of the way Bill played and everybody
Absolutely.
had to work towards it?
Yeah, that's kind of he was one of the, you know, musicians that set that.
Yeah.
Kind of contrapuntal flow of conversation between the two that mm-hmm. Flowed a lot more. Took some of the roles and, you know, reduced those boundaries of bass, do this, you know. And so, you know, he hired Eddie Gomez. Scott LaFaro mm-hmm. was also, you know, innovative in that way, having that kind of conversation.
Yeah.
So we have Scott LaFaro, Eddie Gomez, Mark Johnson. I heard all those trios. Just amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so happy I got to see him live right before maybe he passed
mm-hmm.
here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And yeah.
You know, the thing that I always, am fascinated about with, because there's only certain artists that have done this to me. You tell me if I'm wrong, because you're way more knowledgeable than me. I'm just a drummer within a hot dog stand.
No. referring to the old joke, huh?
But you know, like, so Bill Evans, let's just take it right. He was on the Kinda Blue album.
Correct.
Right? And his playing is a certain way that way.
Right.
To me. And then it keeps evolving and turns into what it is. It's so fascinating to me because, you know, some players, that's the way they sound. That's where they've sounded for 30 years. It's great. It's awesome. It's swinging. But there's only a handful of players that, to me, really play. I mean, completely transform the way they play and just continuously drive the creativity flow of it. I mean, is that what you hear in his playing?
Oh, yeah. He really did have that palette set, mm-hmm. which is what I think Miles loved about him. Is the contrast to what had gone before. He mm-hmm. wanted something different, and they took it modal.
Right.
And then Bill just, you know, kept writing and listening and practicing, and it flowed into this whole other thing in his groups.
Right.
You know, which is part of the transformation.
So now, getting ready for this show, you've got two sets you have to worry about. There's a lot of music to choose from.
Exactly.
Number one. Number two, there's a lot of interesting arrangements, even if you're playing like on Green Dolphin Street, which is a standard.
Correct.
Bill Evans didn't exactly play it like we would do it at a jam session.
No.
So,
thankfully.
So, yeah, right. So how did the process go about picking out some of this repertoire and starting to put it? You're probably in the process of putting it together
actually
right now. But
Yeah. Honestly, putting it together right now. Last night, even, you know, like, what should I do? And I'm looking through the tunes, and it has to do with who's playing too. Since I'm the bass player and not playing the piano,
right?
You know, so I defer to Tom Mueller, mm-hmm. who's done a lot of study on Bill Evans.
That's one of his favorite guys, is Bill Evans.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we're you know, conferring, mm-hmm. you know. Commiserating, all the C words, and on what tunes we'll play.
Okay.
You know, so there'll be some standards and, of course, Bill's tunes.
Right.
You know, and then there's the video time remembered. We might even learn a new tune. We'll see. We'll see. But we want to feel comfortable and we want to present something great mm-hmm. for our audience.
How hard is it for you? I mean, are you going to think of this as you playing, or are you going to kind of think of yourself, putting yourself in the Scott LaFaro, Mark Johnson, Eddie Gomez kind of thing? I mean, because your style lends itself to so many different styles. I mean, trying to get your brain around what's happening probably on the tunes that you're playing, it's probably fun too, right?
Oh, very fun. Actually, I love playing that way, very contrapuntally, and probably I get in trouble in certain bands because I do it.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Play the quarter note and stay there. You know, but this will be fun for me because, like I said, Scott LaFaro is one of my all-time favorites. Eddie, Mark Johnson, you know, I'm going to try and channel them. I can only be me, so, you know, I might, you know, gone astray from the path a little bit, but, you know.
Was Scott LaFaro obviously was a huge influence on you. How did you end up getting into bass? I mean, being an upright bassist, because I'm sure that there weren't all that many women bass players when you were coming up in high school. Were you starting in high school?
Actually, the surprising part of the story is that I was a clarinet player, and my major at college was clarinet.
That was clarinet, really?
So I didn't tell you that before the interview, so I put a little surprise
on
you.
Hey, that's all right.
But, when I got to the last year of high school, they needed a bass player, and I thought, well, I could do that. I really wanted to play jazz saxophone, and he put me in the second band for that, in the first band, because he really needed a bass player.
And why did you think you could? I mean, you just
I didn't
felt like
think
that was
I could play.
Did you think it was cool looking or something? I mean,
not
was
at
any?
All. I just wanted to play jazz, and he needed a bass player, and so I was on electric, and I had to write the letters above the notes because I didn't read bass. I read treble clef like crazy because I was. Went to Illinois State, all the different competitions as a clarinetist.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I got into U of I as a clarinet major, blah, blah, blah.
That's
and
amazing.
So, and then I went, and I was like the lizard of bass at University of Illinois. Everybody saw me and, oh, here she comes, run, you know. And I got in by the skin of my teeth to the sixth band.
Really?
Yeah, by the grace of people that were, you know, doing the audition.
And are you doing like classical saxophone and clarinet, or are you doing
classical clarinet? Yeah.
So that's how you got in, and then you're getting into the jazz thing on the bass side of it, but you aren't exactly a world beater at that point.
No,
so
not
like
at all.
Heading the other direction.
No, they were.
Were you down there with you know, like Joel Spencer and Eric Schneider and
yeah,
I don't
well,
know how long Eric was there? But,
Joel, like people would come back. It's like the city that nobody could get away from. You know, it's like they would
it's
keep coming
vortex.
Back. Yeah, it's a vortex. Suck them right back, and then they'd leave, and they had to come back. And John Campbell, so all these people formed that community.
Okay.
And Joan Hickey, you know, we were in the same, maybe she was a year ahead of me or something. We played together, and it was amazing.
So a lot of your playing, were you taking lessons or were you just learning
I was taking bass lessons and clarinet at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And then I changed my major, and then I never slept, and I had to make a decision. So I sold my clarinet for the rent. My beautiful buffet clarinet mouthpiece, and I wish I hadn't, but anyway, you do what you gotta do.
That's
and
right.
I just focused on bass. I took lessons with that. I applied. I got a scholarship on bass. There was a women's, because I put myself through school. So I went every summer because I kept changing my major from education to applied clarinet and then to jazz bass and composition. Because why? Because there was no jazz actual what do you call it?
Is there a degree? There
no
wasn't
degree,
a degree,
no.
Right? There wasn't
no.
a jazz studies
no,
degree,
no, no, no.
right?
So there was a little asterisk in the bottom of the book, and it said open options. I said, that's me. So I petitioned to get and write my own program, basically. And
wow.
I took a lot of ethnomusicology classes and studied some composition and and picked everybody's brain, and there was such a fabulous community. We'd play sessions all the time.
Yeah.
Listening
there were gigs, sessions too. You guys
listening
listen,
sessions
right?
with groups. Yeah. You know, talking about the music. Then we'd play. Then we'd learn tunes. We'd play at Trino's, the big band Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
There were six big bands there.
That's amazing, isn't
right?
it?
Right.
Is it? Because it was like North Texas and U of I.
Yeah.
Like we're
that was it
the
in Berkeley.
Two big ones in Berkeley.
That was it. But nobody had a jazz. You know,
there's no jazz studies.
No
degree.
Jazz studies degree.
Yeah.
So I made up my own.
It's probably better too, because if there was a jazz studies degree, you would have been locked into some curriculum, and at that point, it probably wouldn't have been the curriculum that people do now. So it probably would have been very, you know, focused on something that maybe you're so wide open with your ears at that point that, you know, somebody would have said, no. You're going to focus just on this direct line to get out of school.
It could be.
You know,
it could be. Some
I mean, I think
that.
Now the jazz studies degrees are probably way more optional, where there's a lot bigger range of things that they're doing and teaching and all that stuff.
Yeah,
but, you know.
It, depending on the climate of any given school, you know, the nice thing about the academia part is the things that we didn't get, you know, we can put into the curriculum, hopefully for, you know, the students now.
Right.
And the things we did get, we'll try and put into the curriculum, like, you guys should be going out to listen to music, you know, or engaging with the students. Like, I went on tour to Mexico with Rodrigo, and two of our grad students.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it gives them insight into what a tour might be like, because those opportunities are falling off in terms of the mentorship of the older cats, and that, so we're the older cats, you know, supposedly mentoring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable, though. I mean, like, you know, when you're in school now, and that's a great point you brought up, like just the tour thing, or just it's like the outside activations that the schools are able to provide, because, you know, even when I got back into town in the mid-90s, there was a lot of, you know, everybody was playing, there was a lot of jam sessions, you were doing stuff, and I mean, some of the situations I got myself playing into, I still can't believe I was playing with some of these guys doing what I was doing. It was no big deal to them. It was a big deal to me.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But I learned a lot, even just from showing up and how to get set up and how to do this, how to do that. But those things are falling by the wayside these days. So it's interesting that the schools are able to do that kind of stuff.
Now,
so
we have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, if we know, we have to share.
Right.
You know, and that's what we need to engage with them and give them that experience. Let you know, mentor them so that they know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Actually set them out there and say, okay, go book it.
Right.
You know, go book the tour, and you teach these young people in the high schools or elementary you know, and put it together, yeah. Take some of the funds from the school, go out there and do it, and yeah. So that they get the experience, so they know how to do that in a professional way, mm-hmm. and instead of like getting out of school not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good to give them a platform.
Well,
to,
and you know this better than anybody because you've been playing for so long and doing so much stuff, but I mean, when kids get out of school, they have to realize they're suddenly in business for themselves.
Right.
There's no like here's
more than ever before.
Yeah, here's your $40,000, you know, gig to play jazz bass over here at the club. I mean, uh-huh. It's like
oh yeah, yeah, sure. I'm waiting for that. Oh yeah, that's on page.
Is that no is it coming up in July?
Yeah, no. It's not in this book. It's not in this date book, but I'm sure it's there.
So do you ever, when it's 20 below zero, miss playing clarinet when you're lugging your bass in?
Oh no, marching band. No, sorry. Yes, I did a ton of marching band.
Oh
man. Yeah, I didn't do the Woody Allen. If you remember Woody Allen, yeah. With the cello in the marching band, he's on the chair and he keeps moving it. No, I didn't get to do that, but I did do strolling bass.
Oh well, I think they still do that at some restaurants.
Yes, of
I think.
Course.
So you're in college and you're getting out. What's your first like breakthrough gig? What's like, all right, cool, this is unbelievable, I finally am playing with somebody that's...
It was actually Stan Getz at the Barrington Jazz Festival.
No kidding,
yeah.
Wow.
And that's where I met Terry Lynn Carrington, Kenny Barron, and Stan Getz. And I worked on all his music, and I got to play Sippin' at Bell's, the melody with him.
Really?
And it was unbelievable. It was so exciting.
How old were you, just out of college?
Pretty much, 25,
yeah.
26.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
Yeah. So it was very exciting. Then they called again. Okay, this is like the mistake of my life.
Oh, no.
I play the worst jobbing date in the world. I can't even remember. I remember the situation. I remember the scene. I remember it was in some weird park. Outside. You know? And I turned down. George Mraz could not make a gig. And they called me to play. You know, with it, right, you'd think it was a no-brainer, but I, you know, I'm a little girl. I'm at that point, I'm lost. Yeah, obviously.
So you
and
played
way,
a jobbing
way,
gig.
Way too loyal, and I couldn't get a sub for it. I should have just said, screw this, I'm going, duh.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but obviously, maybe he was happy with, yeah. You know, my performance.
Yeah. It worked out really for you in the end, anyways.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Well, it isn't over.
There's still time.
There's still time for me to make up for lost, lost time. Yeah, and then the next one was with Joe Henderson.
Okay.
And I think I heard John Whitfield was in New York, and people were looking for a female bassist.
Was he in town? Like Joe was in town, like hiring a local thing, or
no?
What was
he
going
was
on?
Looking. His promoter was looking for an all-female.
Okay.
And somehow John Whitfield was in New York or something, talking to some people, and he recommended me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so I get a call, and I'm like, really? Really? Joe, come on.
You said,
really?
I've got a jobbing gig at
yeah,
a hot dog
no,
stand.
No, I learned. By then, thankfully. Yeah, I am teachable.
So you flew to New York, or how did that whole thing work
well,
out?
Well, I can't remember all the details, but yeah, they sent tickets, and then, you know, I had my bass drunk, and off we went. We went to a Mount Fuji Jazz Festival, which is...
So did you have to audition, or did you just get the gig? Like,
yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Really, there were very few lady bass players at that point, back in the dinosaur age.
Sure.
Now it's like, there's more of us,
mm-hmm.
You know, that play great.
It wasn't that long ago. It's not
no,
the dinosaur
it's not,
age.
No, I know, it's not.
You're not in the field museum or anything.
No.
So you flew out, and that was it. You got the gig, like,
right.
And you flew out.
Right.
So what was the first gig you did? Do you remember with them? Who was in the band?
It might have been. No, I don't think it was. It could have been, Renee Rosness.
Yeah.
Sylvia Cuenca on drums. Joe, myself.
Right.
You know, Cindy Blackman actually was on some gigs, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were in Japan, and you can see on my... Not my website, but on my Facebook page.
Okay.
Yeah. There's an old picture of me with my Jufro. And we all had big hair back then. You know?
Well, you've got the one picture of all of you at the piano, right? I mean, there's
right.
that one
and then
picture.
Roy.
And Roy.
And that's when Roy actually hired us, Roy Hargrove.
Okay.
And so that was the connection there.
Ah, okay.
And then, yeah, which just had an amazing tribute in New York that
mm-hmm.
I went to for him. So, yeah, it was great. I don't know if we were in New York. We played in New York a lot. We played in D.C. We did, Blues Alley. the blue, I don't know, there's a lot of blue.
Right.
You know, in
Blue Whale, Blue Note, Blue This, Blue That.
Well,
yeah.
The Blue Note there, and the we were in Seattle. We did San Francisco, Yoshi's.
Did you move to New York at that point?
Because I didn't really. I was in and out, just in and out. You know, like Joe's in and out, like his album now. You know, I finally remember, got the, oh, I get what that means now, Joe.
In and out. Yeah, now I get it too.
Right.
See, I'm learning here.
I'm going to assume that. It's pretty,
No, that's wild. So you just, boom, you're doing that. And then how long were you with Joe?
Had a couple of years, on and off,
What was that experience like? It had, did it just open up your whole playing, or
It was, well, Joe's was interesting because he never really said much musically about what you should do. You know, he wasn't like controlling, like.
But he liked what you were doing; otherwise, he wouldn't have had you on the gig, obviously.
Obviously,
yeah.
And occasionally, he'd say, "I'd like you to do, check, do that." Yeah, okay, that. Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that line, and then leave space. And then, okay, Joe, okay. And that was it, you know, for the next month. That's about as much direction as I got, you know.
He liked to let you incubate that, probably, and formulate it and do your own creativity, which is dynamite, because of how many artists allow you to do that these days,
and
right?
And have that freedom
to,
like, explore in the moment with the people you're playing.
Yeah.
What a fascinating idea. I mean, that's all music is anyway, in the moment, and, you know.
It is. I mean, you work as much as you possibly can to know the foundation, but then you never know what's going to happen from one tune to another, and you have to rely on everything that you know.
Exactly.
In order to be creative and also keep everything together.
Right.
Right?
Right. You have to know some rules of the road,
and then
rely on your instinct, your definition of instinct, learn... priorly, you know, learned knowledge and whatever else there is, you know, to make the music as good as you can.
Mm-hmm. So when you're touring with him and then you come back, did you go right on the road with Roy Hargrove? Was that like in the mid-90s or something? Or was that?
Well, Roy, I didn't really go on the road with Roy. We just played that, like, a few things in Japan, like that, and a few things here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So Joe was mainly that for me. When that ended, then came back and did a lot of things here. Then there was Nancy Wilson and Joe Williams, and they called me. And they were working for the same manager, so I don't know if Joe came first or Nancy, but Nancy, I toured with her too, went back to Japan and a lot of places all
that
over here.
That had to be a huge tour with Nancy Wilson, right?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And John B. Williams was doing the Arsenio Hall show. So I got called. Oh, you know, I was playing with at the time it was called the Members Jazz Orchestra.
Right.
Now it's the Chicago
Jazz Orchestra.
Yes, Jeff Lindberg
and
that. So we were at Orchestra Hall at the time. It was called that, Symphony Center. And we played with the big band, and I was playing, and she turned around because I was playing, and she was like, "Who's that on bass?" And I was flattered. And then I got the call.
Wow.
And then I worked with Joe, too.
You work with her off and on throughout the years, too?
Yeah, and Joe Williams, too.
Yeah.
So I was on the road with her for a while, then Joe for a while, Williams.
Mm-hmm. You know. So you're touring with Nancy, you're touring with Joe, but you're still calling Chicago your home, so you're in and out of town a lot. I mean, when did you feel like all of a sudden you got your foothold in Chicago? I know that you're teaching now, too. I mean, you're obviously everybody that comes through town, you're playing with here and there, you know, as they have to have local bands. And I know you're traveling still and doing a lot of that stuff, too. But you're also, what's your official title at Roosevelt University and at NIU? Is it instructor of bass or jazz bass?
Well, at NIU, I coordinate the jazz combo program. And I am, I don't know. Lecturer, jazz
sounds
bass,
official. That sounds official.
You know,
yeah,
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt, I'm applied artist, and I did work with a combo. Occasionally, I work with their combos if they need me to.
Yeah,
as well, but mostly students there.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's got to be one of those things. I think is it Roosevelt? They have like different kinds of combos too,
correct.
Right? They have like. What are they? They even have like a hip hop combo or a fusion combo and a straight ahead jazz combo and stuff.
A free combo.
And a free
free
combo.
Free jazz. Yep.
Do you find, because of all your experiences and stuff, the way the jazz studies programs are, especially at Roosevelt, I mean, to me, just looking from, you know, the macro view of it, it really is hitting on all of the different styles of music that a jazz musician actually has to tackle these days, because it's not just like 50 years ago where you just sit down and, okay, now we're playing, I'm in a bebop group and this is what I'm doing. I mean, as a bass player and as a drummer and as any other instrumental, you get on a gig, you might be playing, it might be in the jazz context, but you're playing some hip-hop grooves, you're playing this, you're playing that, you're playing this and playing that, because all of it is kind of part of jazz. So you find like the jazz studies programs are a little bit like growing out organically as far as what's happening around the scene, and it's really like giving the students
well,
such an overall.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, the truth is that I never really played any one particular, that maybe I was typecast more as I was playing in a certain city, or particular because that kind of music worked more.
Okay.
You know, but at U of I was in a free group called the Translucent Whales.
That's a cool name,
right?
Man.
I was in a group called Jack Webb that was 20s music with Ron DeWar those cats playing that, you know, slapping the bass. Then I was in a bebop or whatever came up,
right?
You know, learning that, or Chick Corea or Herbie Hancock, or you know, maybe hip hop wasn't quite then.
Back
you
then,
know, back
but
then,
now,
but
it's,
now,
yeah.
So there's more to learn. You know, still learning the roots of the music. You know, somewhat of the history, so that people have fundamentals. I think is pretty important, and. But also we want to go further and create something new.
Right.
You know, so how do we do that? And how do we get them to use their instincts and go past with the knowledge of, you know, the history of the music and go past that? And when you also, and I know I'm skipping around, when you think about the content of jazz, if we have that name for it, it really is a fusion of many kinds of music, you know. Irish.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's got the straight duple and the triplet. And all of that combines to form this music, you know, when you listen to it. You know, the marching music, the Polish, everything is in there. You know, Art Blakey, you know, he's playing like, well, he would never play the real bossa nova, but he had his own feel. You know, like think Nika's Dream, you know, I mean, which is like, who plays that feel?
Right.
He came up with that.
Right.
You know, it's such a fusion of different kinds of music.
Have you gotten to a point you're playing because you've been doing it for so long that, you know, like for an example, like when I was starting out, I was always worried, okay, this is a, take a bossa nova for example, it's a 3-2 or a 2-3 clave. This is it. This is the way I have to do it. This is the only way to do it. This is, you know. Now I don't care. As long as it feels good, I care less. I don't. Who cares? But are you at a point now in your playing where you're like, "This is my voice. This feels great to me. This is what I want it to sound like." Just because it's normally this is how it is. You don't really care if like so and so did it this way or this guy did it that way or this guy did. This is feels great to me, and this is the way I'm doing it.
Well, no, I'm a little bit movable. Sorry. Yeah, sometimes I am. Sometimes I am. Especially, you know, if it's my group or whatever. But, I mean, as far as the claves and stuff, there's always stuff to learn.
Yeah.
And the other thing about the clave 2-3-3-2, then they have things where they mix them and they go back and forth, and it evolved too.
Yeah.
So I don't know that there's any particularly right way, and I think it has to do with the other musicians you're playing with.
Right.
Their expectations of maybe, hey, we're going to do this in this kind of way. We would like you to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm definitely going to try and do that. I'm going to sound like me anyway. I'm not going
to
sound like
a child. Do you think it's harder to sound on a bass player, find your own voice as opposed to other instruments?
I think it's just hard to find your own voice, period, in some ways. I don't know.
It's super difficult to find your own voice, but to me, like, as a bassist, I just wonder if that's something that's like, man, you know, at least with, like, drums, cymbal patterns and things like that, and touch and all that stuff. I know I know there's still a touch and stuff on bass, but I'm just wondering if there's a more difficult thing, or you probably don't
think
about it that way, right?
No, I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah, you got to think about what kind of tone you want, what kind of strings will help get that tone. The tone can come from you, too. Like if Ray Brown, for instance, plays my bass, he's going to sound like Ray Brown. Sorry. I, you know, and he was a mentor of mine and also a huge influence. So, when I would hear him, I go, Ray, that's not your regular bass. Yeah, I rented it, or I was trying this plywood bass, and I was like, oh, that's the reason your tone, you know, I'm thinking is different, but you're still Ray. Right. I mean, I could close my eyes and walk in the place and know it was Ray.
Right, you know.
But by the way he played, the articulation, by the notes he played, by his phrasing, you know, all those, you know, can combine. And so I think that every musician on any instrument goes through the same thing, you know, if you're interested in evolving into whatever you are.
Right. You know. Well, and that's the whole goal.
Right.
That's the whole goal. And that's bringing it all the way back. Check out this transition, Marlene. Check it out.
Okay.
All right. Bringing it all the way back. Your gig on January 31st.
Yes.
Bill Evans. Talk about a guy with his own voice. So that's going to be at Winters Jazz Club.
Correct.
January 31st. Winters, of course, I should put this in there too.
Please.
465 McClurg Court, Chicago. It's a great listening room. I know everybody that watches this show regularly has heard me talk about it. It's a very intimate room. Perfect for a Bill Evans tribute concert because it's just, you're close, you're right on top of the band. You're going to hear every little nuance of the group. So all the information.
You're frightening me. Every little nuance.
Now you're like, oh God, this was a mistake.
No.
So wintersjazzclub.com. There's tickets. Show's 7:30 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. on January 31st. And then you have another show coming up February 12th.
Correct.
Which you're working out, basically trying to do this thing once a month. And it's the Marlene Rosenberg Quartet.
Correct.
That's a very original name.
I know. I call it MRQ every now and then in keeping the acronyms.
Look at that.
You know, MRQ, that. Marlene Rosenberg Quartet.
And that's got Reggie Thomas on piano, Jeff Bradfield on saxophone, and Greg Atrey on drums.
Archery.
I knew I was going to screw that up because I didn't put the other R in. Yep. Archery. Well, sorry, Greg. On drums. And that's at the Jazz Showcase, 806 South Plymouth Court. And this is going to be probably focused more along the lines of your specific music, right? I mean, you're probably playing some originals, probably playing some different things like that.
Right. And I have a new CD that's going to come out hopefully in April. And,
talk a little bit about that.
And so MLK and Marlene, Lewis, and Kenny. So it's me, Lewis Nash, Kenny Barron, and then Christian McBride and I play some duos. And it's frightening, but you know, he's just such a monster. They all are, actually. So I'm very honored that they're on my project. MLK, obviously, stands for Martin Luther King Jr., too.
Mm-hmm.
The social injustices that we are still having to deal with, you know, that have come to light these days. And Chicago is really struggling. Such a great city.
It is.
You know,
it is.
And I have seen the transition where everybody might be afraid to go to the South Side when I was here in the 80s, but I wasn't really.
Right.
I mean, with a good sense of fear, but not. But now, a lot of those clubs have become with these guns, you know, without sitting on, you know, a perch talking about it. But a lot of clubs have closed. A lot of people, you know.
There used to be a ton of clubs that, I mean, I remember going to on the South Side.
New Apartment Lounge.
Yeah.
All down 70s,
Alexander's. Alexander's, right? I mean, those places. I don't think any of. I know Apartment. I don't think Alexander's is there anymore. I think there's a couple other ones too. They're all gone.
Okay.
And I couldn't even imagine anybody reopening them. How are they going to get people there? So that's a whole issue that they have to take on.
Right.
And so this album kind of has a dual thing because you've got the group, but then also it's got that other significance
to
it, right?
Exactly. So I wrote music in reference to these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about it. We got the last piece we're going to record. It's going to be a little spoken word over something that is already recorded.
Yeah.
And
cool.
I'm excited about that with Tom Burrell, who's a famous and fantastic person in the ad industry,
mm-hmm.
who is now retired. However, he really established in the African-American community some positive images in advertising.
Yeah.
And so he's come on board, thankfully.
Oh, that's
nice,
great.
You know, to do this little piece with us.
So you're thinking about this coming out sometime in April, most likely.
Most likely.
On Origin.
That's most likely.
Most likely.
Looks like
that's
there's
awesome.
A lot of most likely.
I know everything's in flux right now. I know how this whole thing goes.
And I'm probably going to do a 3-week rush campaign for post-production funds. So,
we'll keep you all posted on that, too.
Right, of course.
But, all right, so watch for that. MarleneRosenberg.com?
Yep.
Yeah, no, MarleneMusic.com.
Well, either one will work.
Oh, MarleneRosenberg.com or MarleneMusic.com.
Correct.
Right, so for all the information, she plays all the time as well. So we're talking about two shows, but be sure to check out her schedule there. And also, April, the new release coming out, we'll talk again as that comes out.
Sure.
We'll do something about
Great,
that.
Thanks.
Make sure everybody knows about
Thank
that.
You.
But of course, January 31st, Winter's Jazz Club, Jazz Showcase February 12th. You've got plenty of opportunities to go check this out. And I mean, hopefully, talking to Marlene, you guys have seen her play, but now you know the fascinating story behind Marlene. And you can go in, and if you have a clarinet, I'm sure she'll be happy to talk to you about that too. I'm just kidding.
If I can remember some of the fingering. Each octave's different.
So I learned how to play flute. When I had to, when I was a music ed major for 2 months.
Sure, how'd that
then
go?
I decided, I was only a music ed major for 2 months. That's
That's
how well it went. All right, so as I always say, hopefully Marlene and I see you at one of her upcoming gigs. And if we
come out.
And if we don't, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the scene.